you can really get the timing wrong, and being early is the same thing as being wrong.
Hi, I'm Jeremy Goldman, and this is Future Proof. So today we're talking to Alex Kolacic, a founding partner at 8VC, which pegs itself as a different kind of VC firm. Alex focuses on IT and bio-IT investments, and he's known to be one of the more thoughtful, insightful VCs out there, which is why I wanted to make sure we got him on here for you. We talked to Alex about how he started at Palantir, a mission-driven company, and how tech can be a driving force of change, why healthcare is so freaking resistant to change, how an investor needs to change their way of thinking when the situation changes, and how poker helps you incorporate new data into your decision making. So without further ado, let's jump right in.
So, Alex, welcome to Future Proof.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Yeah, so first off, tell us your full name, title, and what you do building the future on a day-to-day basis.
Sure. My name is Alexander Kolacic. I'm one of the founding partners here at a venture capital fund in Silicon Valley called 8VC. And, you know, we invest in companies across a variety of industries, you know, at the earliest possible stages. And if you go to the website, the tagline is "The world is broken, let's fix it." So we try and, you know, find big industries where we think technology can have an impact and invest in sort of the upstarts that are going to go and try and tackle it to drive change.
Yeah, and that's why I wanted to talk to you, because I love how kind of audacious in a good way that tagline is. I mean, how did you guys come up with that?
You know, I think one of my partners, Joe, started this company, Palantir, out here, a big data analytics firm where I used to work briefly. And, you know, Palantir was a very mission-driven company. It was started to really help the government at the very beginning make sense of all its data and help keep us safe, basically. And so, you know, they came into that with a very philosophical approach, saying we want to make the world a better place. And we really recognized early on that technology is a driving force of change in the economy. And while you can focus on the aspects of making money, and surely, you know, we're fiduciaries to our investors and we try very hard to make a return. I mean, that's really the primary motivation. But, you know, there is this second part to it where if you are actually adding value, and we try and keep that as our true north to create economic value, if you are doing so, you oftentimes change the world. And we try and pick the areas where you change the world for the better. And so we kind of view it as our mission for two reasons. Number one, to drive meaning in our lives, right? That we want to have an impact and we want to create something bigger than ourselves. But number two, it's much easier to rally really smart people around a mission to, you know, actually make the world a better place and to drive meaningful change versus, you know, trying to just pitch the financial aspect.
Yeah, I think it completely makes sense. And I know you focus on a really interesting area of kind of bio IT, right? How do you define that?
Yeah, so, you know, we started the fund in 2011. Formation 8 started then. I wasn't here at the time, but I joined shortly after. And the idea there was really an extension of kind of the things we learned early on in our career, doing a lot of data analytics and sort of workflow software work, where we found that by unifying siloed data sets, putting it all together and building what we call nonlinear workflows on top of those data sets, you're able to drive a meaningful amount of change in a lot of old industries. And, you know, the core tenet we always work with is man-machine symbiosis. It's how can you use the machine to inform the person to make a better decision. Machines are very good at driving insights from large amounts of data. Humans are very good at having intuition to drive insights from small amounts of data. And that's what we did for a good 4 years. We were lucky enough to, you know, a few of our friends were starting companies in the bio space, and we found actually that certain facets of biotech or healthcare IT, we distinguish bio-IT as being more in the biological sciences, you know, typical therapeutics companies, something like that, whereas healthcare IT deals more with IT systems for hospitals, doctors, payer groups, things like that. And we found that in a lot of ways, the challenges some of these companies were facing were data challenges. They were ones that we could solve because we only try and, you know, enter areas where we have a competitive advantage. And so we dug in there a little further and we saw, oh, well, there's a few big trends that are happening in the biological and health sciences, which are really creating huge amounts of data. And a lot of these companies now are limited by the analytics or informatics work, you could call it, to derive insights from this data that's being generated. And that's our competitive advantage. So that's kind of how we got into it. We saw an area that was changing. We saw, hey, we can help here. And also, you know, we can do things like cure cancer or help early detection of cancer, things like that. So, you know,
I mean, I love that particularly you guys pay attention to these broken industries or areas where you can make a sizable difference in building a better future in a shorter time period. But I actually think a lot about the healthcare industry. Why do you think the healthcare industry as a whole is so resistant to change, especially technological change? Is that, you know, just bureaucracy or inertia or something else?
We tend to look at industries pretty top down. And so there are generally laggard industries and there's early adopter industries. And typically areas like government and healthcare have been laggard industries. There's things I think that are structural and things that are, I think, just endemic to the way medicine is operated. It's not the fastest moving field in terms of, you know, information being disseminated across the system. It takes things sometimes over 10 years to become the standard of care. And so because we're dealing with people's lives, there's a higher bar to actually proving that what you're doing is a meaningful improvement over the status quo. But, you know, we also find that there are confounding factors in the regulation that make it difficult sometimes to enact change. So in most cases, in most industries, we look at, are there problems and challenges that need to be solved? And are there startups and technology that can solve those problems? And usually those two things are sufficient, that we have a company that can solve the problems and the problem does exist. And usually then that means we invest. However, the system in healthcare is extremely complicated. And so you actually have to think pretty deeply about how do the policies and the incentives and regulations mesh with this change you're trying to enact? And are people within the system incentivized actually to, you know, enact this change? And oftentimes that
how about if
time.
We just jump into a very quick lightning round, somewhat irreverent random questions, just so people can get to know you a little bit better.
Yeah, absolutely.
What's one thing about you that has nothing to do with business that we'd never guess, that most people don't know about you?
Earlier on in my career, I used to be semi-competitive poker player, and I kind of tend to think that that's one of the most formative experiences of my life that made me a good investor inherently. And so I don't
favorite think way to celebrate after a big win, like closing a new round or another big accomplishment.
I'm a bit of a foodie, so generally it's going to one of the nicer restaurants in San Francisco, getting, you know, the whole team and group of advisors together and enjoying
okay,
a great
that's
meal.
Oddly enough, very similar to my next question. Typical meal when you're on the road scouting for new companies or managing existing ones?
In general, I'm a sandwich guy. I like a good Subway sandwich or pastrami or something like that. And I
can you guys find a way to make those healthy? Because if you invest in a company that can just make like a nice, big, giant pastrami sandwich and make it a health food in some way, shape, or form, I feel like you guys will do pretty well in that investment.
We are actually looking at like how you can hack nutrition, but it
nice,
goes
okay.
a little further off.
Yeah, exactly. That's the whole flip side. You know, you find a way to, make it healthy and then you lose the other things that made you want it in the first place. So I know a lot of our listeners are familiar with Peter Thiel. Since you've worked with him a little bit, right? Sum him up in one sentence.
Yeah, so I worked with Peter for, I think it was about 6 years. I'd say the things you see about him are it depends how you perceive him, but you know, I found him to be extremely generous, extremely wise, and extremely contrarian in a lot of the way he thinks about things, but
yeah,
in a good
it's,
way.
It's always something that I would say that everybody should be looking for in a leader or investor. And actually, last lightning round question, favorite cities to pay attention to with respect to investing? Do you have any hotbeds of innovation that you're paying attention to?
This is truly a self-serving answer because I went to school in Waterloo in Canada and I'm from the area. But I think, you know, Waterloo in Toronto as a region is extremely well primed to, you know, continue delivering a lot of innovation. I think it's an underappreciated area. You know, elliptic key cryptography was invented there. The first search engine was created by OpenText, invented there. Some of the first C compilers were invented in Waterloo region. You have a lot of companies like ATI started there. And so it's an area, the smartphone was invented there. And so you have this region that historically has been incredibly important to the history of computation in general, and mobile computation in particular. And I don't think people recognize it for what it is, but I think it's one of, or and will be, continue to be one of the most important areas where technological change is
very true. And actually, the Collision Conference, I don't know if you know, is moving to Toronto as a testament to how much innovation is happening around there, how many interesting companies are in the area. So, okay, so just kind of moving on, I figured let's go back to healthcare for a second, because I'm wondering what you think, what impact will technology have on healthcare providers who work outside of hospitals and institutions, you know, like doctors with their own practices, in-house aides, and so on? Is that an area that you're paying attention to or investing in at all?
Yeah, absolutely. So I think maybe it's good to start and just level set and explain the changes we've seen that are driving sort of this change in incentives, which will lead to, I think, a change in action by doctors and the way medicine is delivered. About 10 years ago, the High Tech Act was passed, which incentivized the use of EMRs, basically electronic medical records. And we've seen actually kind of crazy change over the last decade, where if you look 10 years ago, roughly 90% of all electronic records were kept on paper. And today, about 90% are kept electronically. It's probably one of the like fastest adoption curves we've ever seen in medicine. And that's happened about the same time as there's been a push towards value-based pricing and value-based care. So in the past, a doctor used to get paid per procedure. We call it a fee-for-service. You do something, you get paid. That obviously sometimes incentivizes more procedures versus a better quality of care. So the system has moved towards value-based care, where you get paid in a bundle for a certain, you know, a hip replacement has a fixed fee. And in that case, providers are then incentivized to give you a high quality of care at the lowest possible cost, not necessarily at a higher cost. And that's led to real push from doctors and provider groups and things like that to find ways to reduce the costs of care and to keep it high quality, which is, I think, a general positive for the system. And so the reason I think the EMR part in particular is important is because, you know, we talk a lot about AI and data science and things like that and how it'll impact medicine. But what's usually lost in that conversation is that while the techniques of stats and AI are very important to driving change and finding novel workflows and things like that to make care get better, the data aspects of it are equally as important, where you're only really as good as the data you have to train your models on. And so before electronic medical records, it was very difficult, actually impossible, to understand what was going on in the real world. We call it real world evidence of medicine, and to learn from that in any systematic way other than, you know, colloquially through papers or doctors or research. Whereas now we have this huge corpus of data that we can use to learn, you know, what are the optimal care pathways that physicians should be doing. Payer groups, so insurance companies, can do population health management, saying, let me look at my population as a whole, find out through, you know, data science or some sort of AI analytics, which populations can I intervene in to make them healthier, or which are who are at risk of getting sick that I can now identify and call them up and say, hey, you should try XYZ. And I think in general, those trends are changing it such that I think the iteration speed in medicine will become a lot faster once we start incorporating this real world.
How far along are we on that innovation curve? Because is it the kind of thing where we're already at the point where we can have some interesting observations, such as for whatever reason, people who complain about hiccups at age 43 tend to you know, that tends to be highly correlated with a specific type of cancer, and that, you know, 3 years down the line. Like, is that just the stuff of science fiction where we can start to draw some interesting corollaries that we would have never had before? Is that something that we're 10 years out? Or, because I think that's one thing that a lot of people are curious about, is exactly how far along are we with respect to making use of all of this data that we're capturing?
In limited ways, like a population health management system to say, hey, this group of diabetics should try this, you know, or pre-diabetics should try this diabetes prevention program, that's here today. We can do that. To do more advanced care routing, like you're talking about, correlating some symptoms to some phenotype, that's a little further away. I'd say that's 5 years away. And it's not really, I would say, a problem of techniques or algorithms or anything like that. It's a problem of data. We have two problems. EMR data today is digital, but not structured in ways that we need it to be able to derive these novel insights. So we need really evolution on that side. As number one. And number two, the data sharing within the industry is still rather siloed. So it's rather challenging to get multiple provider groups to pool all this data together. And to learn anything, really, you need a lot of examples. And we don't have that today. But it's starting. So, you know, we're starting to tie genomics data with EMR data. So you can start correlating genomic defects with disease and things like that. We're starting to have EMRs in certain verticals, like oncology or something like that, where they are more structured. Companies like Flatiron are doing a good job of this, where we can now start learning the care pathways that make sense. You know, you can start tying genomic signatures to medicines that you should take for your particular indication. Foundation Medicine does this quite well. And so we're in the early stages of it, but I think it'll be over the next 5 to 10 years that really a lot of change is going to happen.
Yeah, I think it's going to be an exciting time. I mean, I'm wondering also, how about in terms of anything that you're following, any instances where advances in biotech have led directly to advancements in treatment or understanding of a disease, if there's any particular area like that you're following?
It's happening every day. I'd say we're closest to it in oncology. And cancer in particular is very complicated. Not all mechanisms are understood. You know, the thing that really has blown my mind that's changed even over the last 3 or 4 years has been the rise of cell-based therapies. And really, these things called CAR-T therapies, where you have some sort of late-stage blood cancer and all chemotherapy fails. They're able to take your immune cells out of your body, reprogram them to attack a certain cell type within your body that might be cancerous, and they put them back in your body, and it can wipe out the cancer, you know, over 50% of the time. And that always struck me as sort of obviously the future, right? Most things in your body are driven by cells. And the way you fight disease is mostly driven by cells. And so it's very natural to me that the future of medicine, at least in certain indications, is going to be around reprogramming cells. You know, I think in the past we always thought it would be nanobots, but I'm more convinced now that it's going to be cell-based therapies. And as we learn more and more about how to program biology, we can make them more specific and we can make them more targeted and do much, much cooler things and go after a bunch of different indications, not just cancer, not just...
But what's interesting to me, and this is why I love talking to people in the investment community, is that they have an incentive. You know, you were talking about incentives before. They've got incentives to get these things right, which means they're often not so dogmatic. And I find that the people who get on TV as pundits on an ongoing basis, they are more dogmatic, you know, where they believe that one trend is going to be the future. And even when the data kind of proves them wrong, they still hunker down and they keep on saying the same exact things. And so I think what's interesting to me is that your job is to essentially notice trends and to say, well, you know, nanobots were possibly what the future would look like, and maybe they still have a place, and they probably do, but there were other areas where you should focus your time and investment. So what's your process like in kind of questioning your own beliefs in terms of identifying new trends or saying, you know what, I thought a certain thing was going to be big in the next 18 months, but the reality is there are certain conditions that mean it's something that might not break for another 5 or 7 years. You know, how do you, like, what's your process and essentially helping yourself figure out the future and what is going to break big and when?
You know, I'll admit the when is very challenging. I've been someone who's been very focused on robotics. And I think, you know, we're always 1 or 2 years away from a huge inflection point where we'll deploy a lot more industrial robots and things like that. But we're not quite there yet. Autonomous robots, I should be clear. And so I'd say the when is very difficult. You have to look at the state of technology, but it's always a moving target. And it's really hard to predict how quickly that innovation will happen, how quickly the reliability of technology will happen, how quickly costs will come down. So that is generally pretty hard to predict, I'll be honest with you. And that's, I think, part of the reason why venture investing is so risky and so many investments do fail, because it's very common. You'll see a trend, you know, the world is going to look like that going forward. You know, my mental model is, let me think about how the world looks like 100 years from now. Is this the way it works? And if the answer is yes, then it's a question of timing. And that's a hard question, but at least I know that we're in the right direction, right? Investing in the right future. Whereas you can really get the timing wrong, and being early is the same thing as being wrong. And so there's no magic bullet there. We try and evaluate the current state of technology. We try and talk to people smarter than us. We try and talk to academics and entrepreneurs and people in our community to get, you know, where the status quo is, how quickly it can improve, but, you know, we're never 100%.
When you're looking to see a particular technology or platform, and when you're looking to see when something's going to break big or not, what are the most important factors? Is it to see whether or not the management is strong in a team, or that it's a technology on the rise, or that there's very little friction to adopt this new thing, or very little regulation? I'm sure it's a combination, but what are some of the factors that you feel are most useful for you to determine what direction things are going?
Yeah, it's a good question. You know, the thing that we always remember in venture, and this is, I think, the core tenet I learned from Peter, and that I think every good venture investor and angel investor should internalize, is that if you're wrong, you lose 1x. If you're right, you can make 10x plus. And so you shouldn't really be afraid of risk. You should be afraid of being too comfortable. Sometimes the well-worn path is actually the most dangerous one, because everybody else is going down that path, and competitors emerge over time that you would never think of because it's obvious to everybody else. And so you want to definitely be in an area where the upside is extremely high. So we tend to, you know, push ourselves towards opportunities where we can envision at least a 10x over the next, let's say, 7 to 10 years, and try and not do anything other than that, because then you have to really start managing your downside. Whereas when you have asymmetric upside, you don't worry about downside as much. We focus a lot on teams, even sometimes much more than exact ideas or technologies. But I tend to think, like, in venture investing, it's a lot different than private equity. You're not investing really in the present. You're investing in the future. And the future is dynamic. And the future is a product of the people you have at the company. They're going to have to pivot. They're going to have to build the product. It's a lot more about what they will do, how they will adapt, than what they've done so far. And so we try and make sure that the team is extremely strong. They have at least somebody who knows the domain, and they have a lot of really smart engineers on the team, because having really good engineers that can, if anyone's read the book, The Mythical Man Month, you'll know there's these certain engineers that are 10x better than others. Having those 10x engineers really helps you operate quickly. And as a startup, speed is your friend. That's your competitive advantage. But time is your competitive disadvantage, because you're always on the clock. And so you need to have a team that can move and operate really quickly. And then lastly, kind of like I mentioned before, we try and make sure that what they're doing operates on some wave or some technological change that opens up the opportunity set of what's possible today that wasn't possible before. Sometimes things that were not possible before, or were possible before, work. But most oftentimes, innovation happens when there are these ideological changes or technological changes that really open up what's possible in an industry, and that's how you create the value. So we try and make sure that there is a great team, and at the very least, it's pointed in the right direction. Good industry, good market, and riding a technological wave that will be a
challenge. How do you correct for your biases when... I guess the way that, you know, best way to describe that is, like, let's just say if you or another investor has a particular bias towards nanobots, you just find them interesting, and you believe that that's going to be big. And then there are certain market conditions that change, maybe the technology, the adoption curve, or just the ability to get a certain, you know, nanobots out to the market tends to look a lot slower than you had thought a year ago. So how do you correct for your biases, or at least try to be aware of them as a, you know, a forward-looking investor?
Yeah, and it's particularly difficult in venture because the feedback loops are so long. You make an investment, you don't quite know if it'll be successful for several years. So it's hard to learn. And really, this is where I mentioned at the beginning of the interview about poker and how I thought it made me a better investor. And I think it does, like, being competitive in some sort of game really helps you internally build a sort of framework to get better at something and to be intellectually honest about if you're right or wrong and what the actual tea leaves are telling you. Like, what, ignore your biases. In poker, if you're biased, you can always find a way to say the move I made is correct. But then you lose money, and it's pretty quickly that you figure out, okay, I need to adjust my strategy. So the feedback loops there really quickly. So I think great investors are extremely good at being unemotional about their decision-making and taking every piece of new data that comes in and being fairly honest about how it affects
sorry, just follow up. How do you even know if you're being emotional or not? I mean, because it's one of those very difficult things where everybody can say, I'm making an entirely unemotional prediction here, but how does one know? It's not like you're really, you can't give yourself a lie detector test, or there's no way to step on a scale of sorts to know if you're actually taking the emotion out of the equation, right? So how do you do that?
Part of it is, this is what separates amazing investors from good investors. I think part of it is having a good team around you, which helps keep you honest. You know, I have four other partners here and a whole investment team that I can talk things through with. We can do an honest assessment of, like, where is this company now? Where is this trend today? Is it moving in a different direction? And we're actually lucky enough to be surrounded by really smart people who pitch us ideas at the early stages. And so, you know, part of why we are able to identify trends so quickly is because people at the earliest stages come here and pitch us new ideas. And if we start seeing, okay, these new ideas, the trend of this market is shifting away from where we initially thought it was going to be, we have sort of that external validation that says, okay, there's a few data points that suggest maybe we made the wrong decision. And everybody who we think is really smart in this space is going in the other direction. Let's reevaluate.
So you mentioned that you have a really strong team that you work with. And I was wondering, there's a certain wisdom of the crowd, which is true in that aggregate forecasts are better than individual ones, you know, 15 to 20% better to be precise. So if we know this is to be, if we know that this is true, why don't we run our businesses that way typically?
We mostly agree with that. And that's why the way we structure our investment team here is very collaborative. You know, we try and make it so there's no ownership of any individual deal with one partner or one investment team member, that everybody has collective ownership over companies. We're pretty transparent in what's going on with companies, and we try and, you know, leverage everyone's expertise to come up with a way to help one of our companies, or to come up with a decision on strategy or something like that. So we do try and incorporate that. However, sometimes, you know, venture is a convictions business. And I think decision-making, especially in early stage startups, is a convictions business. And so, you know, sometimes disagreement can be good because it means the idea is unintuitive. And unintuitive ideas are usually extremely good ideas or extremely bad ideas. And so I think a very successful investor, and I think a very successful organization in particular, will mesh the two together. Where sometimes the data is not available to actually make a decision, and it's better to make some decision than no decision. And I think human intuition actually has a lot of inherent information in it, And intuition is not really a group activity. It's more of an individual activity. And so we try and let the person closest to the problem make the final call. But I do think combining the two approaches is the right one. Let's get all the information on the table. Let's know all the known knowns. And then we have to make a gut call on the unknown.
I flip those around all the time, by the way. So, Alex, let me ask you one last question, if I can, which is, what is the thing that you are personally working on right now that you're able to talk about that's the most exciting to you?
It's really the advances that are happening in cell and gene therapies and the way that computation is helping accelerate those things. You've just had this, you know, perfect marriage of computation getting better, big data computation in particular being commoditized. So, you know, you could use Amazon and operate on petabytes of data overnight if you wanted to. I mean, it's expensive, but you could do it. You couldn't do that 15 years ago. Data collection through genomic sequencing becoming a lot cheaper. I mean, it's declined at a faster than Moore's law pace. DNA synthesis getting cheaper. EHR data becoming available to correlate, you know, this phenotypic data with genomic data. All these things sort of happening, and genomic editing becoming cheap as well with the advances in CRISPR and other genomic editing techniques. And all these things coming together at the same time is really driving certain areas of biology to look a lot more like computation problems, or at least certain elements are like computation problems. But the advantages you get there are just faster iteration speeds. And so I think that's directly manifesting itself, like we talked about before, in cell therapies to fight cancer, eventually autoimmune disease. But if you take it one step further, and this is like really mind-blowing to me, it's also manifested itself in genetic engineering and gene therapies. And so at the end of last year, you saw the FDA approve the first ever in America gene therapy, Luxturna, which, you know, if you step back and just take and think about it, like, this is a revolutionary time. Obviously, there's lab work that had to get there. There's lab techniques that had to happen to, you know, actually be able to create the drugs to make these changes. But the computation was essential as well to understand the genome well enough to know what genes do I edit, what genes do I knock in. We're actually changing like the way human beings are coded, like their source code, if you want to think about it like computer science. And if you take a step back, and you know, there's a lot of implications to it, but that's only going to increase. There's other, you know, therapies that are getting to market for hemophilia and these other genetic disorders, and it's going to go well past that. That always blows my mind. And, you know, it's something you probably couldn't even fathom 30 years ago. And now it's just becoming table stakes. So it's really interesting to me. And I think that's one of the most cool things happening, how we're going to, you know, use all this knowledge we learn about human beings and how we're programmed, how we're going to, you know, use it to make people healthier, and eventually how we're going to handle the ethical complications that come up of, like, you know, making, you know, superhumans or whatever it is. It's going to be really interesting to see, but I think it's
amazing, and I think it's very cool work that you do, and appreciate you making the time to talk to us, especially given how amazing your track record has been in kind of very stoically surveying the market and looking to see what are the areas worth investing in and what are the areas that are worth it for everybody who's not an investor, who's not a VC, to just be focusing their time. So, Alex, thank you so much for making the time to talk to us.
Thanks for having me. It was a lot of fun.
Thanks again to Alex, and thanks to all of you at home or wherever the heck you are for listening, as always. Make sure to rate us and review us on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or wherever you're listening. Once again, I'm Jeremy Goldman signing off, and you've been listening to Future Proof.